Hello and welcome to Great Things with Great Tech, episode 7. My name is Anthony Spiteri, and this podcast is all about highlighting companies doing great things with great tech. And in this episode, I'm really pleased to be talking to Sheng Yeo, co-founder and CEO of Orion VM. Welcome to the show, Sheng.
Hi, Anthony. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It's great to have you here. So just before we kick off and talk about Orion VM, I'm really excited about getting into the history of Orion VM. Just to remind everyone out there, that if you love great things with great tech and would like to feature on the show future episodes, you can click on the link in the show notes or go to launch at gtwgt.com and register your interest. And just a reminder as well, past episodes are always going to be available on YouTube and all podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We're pretty much everywhere these days, which is great. Love the Anchor, which gets us on everything. And if you would want to subscribe, there's a little icon in the bottom right-hand corner on YouTube. Please click that. And if you're on the podcast listening to this, please subscribe to your favorite podcast. All right. And with that, Sheng, let's get into it. Orion VM, just firstly, let's chat about you a little bit in terms of where you came from. You're in Sydney right now. Were you born and bred Sydney?
So I was born in Singapore. I moved to Sydney when I was 4. So pretty much born and bred here and went to school in the northwest of Sydney. Mm-hmm.
Singapore, I love Singapore. It's easily my second favorite city mm-hmm. in the world. That's for sure. Great place.
Yeah, definitely.
So Sydney boy, went to university. In 2010, what were you, first year university or second year university?
Technically second year, but I actually started working full time straight out of high school.
As
an accountant of all things.
An accountant?
Exactly. Yeah. And I was working at Ernst & Young actually as a financial auditor for 2 years.
Wow. Straight out of high school.
Yeah. It was what they call a cadetship or an intern. Like it was like a training program where we started at 18, worked crazy hours, but learned a lot. As we basically went to university, I met a couple of mates of mine there and we started Orion on the side. And that's basically how the journey began.
Right. So co-founded by yourself, Alex Sharp and Joseph Glanville in 2010. Basically Orion VM, it's a different sort of cloud platform, right? Like, and we'll get into the specifics what it actually is, what it does and how mm-hmm. it works. Cause I think it's so much different to anything that really is out there. I mean, in terms of technology use, how you decided to architect and what you've decided to focus on as your sort of go to market. But just tell us a little bit about how the company actually started. What got you from going from an accountant of all things to starting up a cloud company?
Yeah, so it's actually an interesting story. Like I've always, on the personal side, I've always been into like electronics and tech and things like that. I think I saw the opportunity to learn a lot in the business field. And so I went into the accounting field, but over a couple of years, it definitely was obvious it wasn't for me. So I actually left that field and went back to study IT full time. And that's where I met Alex and Joseph too. And that's where Orion effectively began. So we were toying late 2009, we were actually toying around with the idea of building something. Alex and Joseph were building an AI learning search engine and they had to host that somewhere all things. And they needed to host that somewhere. So we were looking at AWS. It was very much in its infancy back then. And we realized, that their IO performance, their database performance was all very slow back then compared to what it is now. Yeah. And so we realized, there has to be a different way of doing this. And that's how the idea for Orion was born. It was actually meant to be the side project. It was meant to be, all right, we'll start a small hosting company to generate some revenue to be able to fund the rest of the tech we wanted to build. And ultimately, we built some really great technology and eventually pivoted to making that the core business.
So it sounds like you guys were almost, well, Alex and Joseph were almost trying to mm-hmm. be a Google, like trying to start a Google competitor.
Yeah, I think as a bunch of, so Alex, Joseph, and I were quite young at the time, right? So Joseph was 17, Alex was 18.
Let's click back on that because you are still extremely young, in terms of when you say you started a company in 2009 and all this kind of stuff, but mm-hmm. how old are you and the guys, you in your early 30s?
So I'm 31 going 32. Alex is 29 going 30. and we've been running. So in February, we actually, the company turned 10. So
that's a crazy. You know, it seems like, you know, not, I don't know how to say this in a way that's not almost insulting, but it's almost like you should be older. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I definitely feel older, put it that way.
It's a lot of years in the cloud world, right? But so you guys literally started this, you know, it's a great startup story out of, you know, three guys in high school, in university, thinking about a way to do something to solve a problem, which was, you know, for an AI situation, pivoted to a cloud company and then basically grew from there.
Yep, definitely.
So what's really funny as well, and I've talked about this a little bit in previous episodes, around, you know, that time when I was starting to work in serious cloud companies. I mean, obviously I worked from a hosting provider in the 2000s, but then we moved to a cloud company. That's when you and I first crossed paths, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
So
it's been almost, I would say it's almost 10 years ago now, or 9 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years almost exact, right? Because I, you know, when I was trying to work on Anatel's first cloud, I'm using vCloud Director at the time, I was doing a heap of research on just general cloud platforms, right, at the time.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of, I'm still very aware, I'm hyper aware of competition and, you know, who's out there doing the same things that we're doing from that point of view. So I always wanted to keep an eye on things. And Orion VM popped up and, you know, I think I chatted to you, we got talking and you gave me what ended up being a really early beta account. In fact, I've still got memories in my head, specifically where I was at my mum's place out the back at our basketball court with my mobile phone, having a chat to you. And we were just discussing the ins and out of the platform. So what was happening? So 2010 was all about, you know, betering. How do you start a cloud company like that, which is so different?
It's an actually interesting question, actually. Like, I think that Alex and I talk about this a lot over a beer sometimes. And I think that if we were 10 years older, we wouldn't have done it. I think there was a lot of, naivety and a lot of just like, we had nothing to lose being a bunch of teenagers wanting to start this. Right. So, while I was at EY, I'd saved up a decent chunk of money. So we, not massive amounts, but enough to buy the first batch of servers for Orion. So when, like I said, we were young, we said, all right, let's just go all in and start something. And I bought tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment and just said, all right, hopefully we can make this work.
Yeah.
Like I said, if it was me now, being married and having a family and everything, I don't think we would have done the same thing, but it's been a heck of a journey.
Early risk, high reward sort of situation. But so, and going back to why I came across you guys, it was, again, I've talked about this before, the console. I went back in 2000, it seems so trivial today, but back in 2009-10, when you're looking to evaluate, you know, cloud platforms, having access to the VM console was so important. Key almost, you know, and when I looked at it, there was really only a couple of people that were offering it back in the day. And that's why I got onto you guys. Just talk a little bit and let's talk now about the technology stack that you started
with. Yeah, definitely.
And how it was so different to what everyone else was doing at the time and is really still different today.
Yeah. So in summary, basically what our tech platform looks like is now what is called effectively a hyperconverged platform where CPU memory and so compute and storage assets are all on the same machines and we run a distributed cluster. Back then we were calling it a DSAN or a distributed SAN. We know, like, the enterprise way of building infrastructure then was the traditional, it still is in a way, three-tier approach of you find a storage vendor like VMware, like EMC or NetApp, you buy storage, you buy compute, you connect it using iSCSI or fiber channel.
Yeah.
And effectively you have what we were looking at back then is like effectively a lot of single points of failure where you still have redundant switches, redundant storage, but it didn't completely scale linearly as you built infrastructure. Also, we didn't have, to be honest, we didn't really have the money back then to buy an EMC or
those things would cost like a small house, right? Or even a big house.
Exactly. If not a big house, So, and we've heard so many, over the years, we've heard so many horror stories about how you lose the controller on the SAN and you lose everything, right? And it just...
I've got the scars.
We wanted to get
I've
away
got
from
the scars.
That. Yeah. So you want to get away from that. And so what we decided to do was try to go avoid that and build... Like back in those days, peer-to-peer was such a big thing as well. And so we were trying to take some of those HPC peer-to-peer architectures and bring it to more of the enterprise world.
Yeah.
And so what we ended up doing was build a completely distributed storage system, was a completely distributed block store running on top of this new interconnect that we'd found called InfiniBand.
InfiniBand. Okay.
Yeah.
Hit that up later.
we'll come back to that. But yeah, it's basically a very high performance interconnect using currently about 460, I think, or 470 of the top 500 supercomputers in the world. And it's definitely was born as a HPC interconnect for high speed memory sharing.
Yeah.
And effectively we use that RDMA technology in InfiniBand to allow us to do distributed block storage across multiple nodes. So what Orion VM does, similar to a peer-to-peer architecture back in the day, is effectively every single server has assets. And when you run a VM on a server of ours, the storage driver would actually be connecting to multiple physical hosts at one time to replicate storage and effectively deliver the same redundancy profile as having a HA SAN, but doing it as a subcomponent of a tradition of each individual node. Sorry, it's a bit hard. It's so much easier to whiteboard this.
No. I'm getting it. And believe me, the listeners out there who are, you know, of that ilk will definitely be understanding. But so just to step back though. So when a VM's running, basically the storage could be local, or it could be distributed. It could be somewhere else. I could be getting data from somewhere else, or is it all getting data from a single host, or is it distributed data as well?
You know, so it's fully distributed. So the way that if you were to divide cloud platforms in 2010 or 2011 down the line, there were the cheap and nasty VPS providers, which is, or virtual private server providers, which effectively was a single server and you just chopped up a slice of it.
Yeah.
And you had zero flexibility. If you remember back then when you bought from Rackspace, you had to, if you bought 8 gig VM, you had to buy a certain amount of storage because what they were doing was just ratioing up the box. And then you moved into the enterprise world where you had a separate storage array and separate hypervisors, in which case you could mix and match storage. And we wanted effectively, like with our staff, we brought that all together so that you could leverage high-speed DAS storage in a redundant fashion using our replication, but at the same time allow you to mix and match. So our business models were trying to be very flexible in that when you turned off a server, you were not paying. Like our methodology today is the same. Like if you turn something off that we can resell to someone else, then we're not billing the customer for it. So back in the day with Rackspace, if you turned a server off, you still paid for the whole.
Yeah.
For the RAM and the CPU, because they couldn't sell it to someone else because it was tied to that storage until you deleted it. On Orion's end, it was completely separated. But just to get back to the technicality, basically every single hypervisor when you bring it had storage on it. And when you brought up a VM, our distributed SAN driver would effectively connect to multiple hosts and perform storage replication in real time below that block device that we're presenting to the VM.
Yeah. And this is KVM, right? You guys use KVM?
It's Zen. So we started with Zen. We have KVM support now, but back then, Zen was known as was what Amazon was built on back then as well. And it was kind of the trusted, more secure hypervisor compared to KVM back then. But obviously, they've both come a long way. But yeah, so it's Zen based. We use Linux as our operating system, and then on top of that, with Zen, we could run Windows, Linux, FreeBSD, just anything we needed at the guest level. But everything below that was Linux.
And are you guys doing a lot of, you guys have coded, and you guys do any kernel level stuff or any programmatical stuff? You must be doing that to basically make it work on your own. Is that your IP? Is that kind of the secret source of what
it is? Exactly, yeah. So we effectively what we have, like what we just call it the Orion base image, but it's effectively a hyperconverged OS. It's Linux and Zen based, but we have our own kernel patches, our own distributed block storage drivers. And then on top of that, we actually have our own orchestrator that ties that all together.
Yeah.
So our backend provisioning stack is custom. Our front end is all custom code as well. And it's been iterative. Like we're quite mature now in what we call our version 3 of our platform. We had a version 1, a version 2.
Yeah.
And we're starting to obviously build onto the next version of the stack. But the core has been very fundamentally the same in terms of the distributed storage architecture. And what we've done is, like, if you remember our old portal, it was very rudimentary. It's basically now moving a lot of that into a lot more business logic. The last couple of years of writing code for the wholesale model has been primarily around actually the business model, the white labeling, all of that web side of it. And the core has gone stronger. But
Let's chat about that a bit and keep on going through the early years, because I think you guys went live in 2011 was when you guys officially...
2011, it was,
And the landscape in Australia back then in terms of, again, hyperscalers or even public clouds was you had Amazon doing its thing, but not really there entrenched. It still was very much based on hosted providers becoming infrastructure providers or managed service providers becoming infrastructure providers, right? And VMware as well, predominantly, a little bit of Hyper-V. So for you guys to be on Zen and offer something different, but I think what you guys offered even from the start was that wholesale approach, right? And did you, I forgot, did you guys have a public facing portal with a credit card situation?
Or? Yeah, so we didn't actually start as a wholesale provider. When we launched it in 2011, we were just a straight retail IaaS provider. And at that point, there was no Azure, no AWS in Australia. It was a couple of years later that they actually entered the market. And when they started entering the Aussie market, and when we started going to the US, we realized that effectively we had to pivot into a slightly different niche because we didn't want to be in the crosshairs of a billion-dollar marketing budget, effectively, from a retail perspective. But at the beginning, we were one of Australia's, I think there were three or four of us, basically, Australian cloud providers that could do a swipe a credit card and launch.
So let's think back. So obviously, I know Zettergrid because I was there when I eventually moved there. And then there was Orion. And there was also one called Ninefold, from memory.
Ninefold, back on Macquarie Telecom.
Yeah, so Ninefold had a very unfortunate end due to some very poor technical choices that they made. But that was the risk back then. So you got, and to be fair, it could have happened to anyone really, you know, in terms of everyone was getting people moving to the platform, everyone was getting workloads put on. Unfortunately, some ended up having some major issues, which, you know, if you're a customer consuming a cloud and you've made the move to this new platform and it goes pear-shaped, it's a horrible feeling, right? But for you guys,
it was definitely more of the Wild West. Now, if you look at the cloud industry today, it's actually quite boring because everybody
just kind of works. Like
it works exactly. It's a utility now, effectively. So
no one pulling power from other people's racks under the floor and putting it for their own and all that kind of stuff. Like I might have done once or twice. It was crazy. But I think what made you guys, what I can see from the history as well, now looking through 2013, 14, as you started moving to the States, was that your stability and your speed was a big factor. And from memory, in 2011, were you rated the fastest cloud in the world or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So there was actually a cloud benchmarking site back in the day called Cloud Harmony.
Cloud Harmony. Yes, I remember. And I only know
Jason Reed, who runs that.
I know this because I went on it only after I saw you guys talk about how you guys are the fastest. And I was like, they can't be the fastest, surely. So I went on there and tried to test.
Yeah, so Cloud Harmony actually is now owned by Gartner. So Reed, who runs that, sold it to Gartner as a data source. But no, like, so he benchmarked and tested everything. And you could definitely get faster. I think the specific, we were definitely the fastest network back storage in the cloud. Like, you could get faster local storage, but that had no replication and none of that.
Anyone could chuck SSD.
Combine the two. Yeah. Exactly. Back then, even like, there were no SSDs, right? So we literally, like, we got our speed in our platform by just having a whole hell of a lot of spindles. And we could easily do that because every server of ours had 12 to 16 drives and we were aggregating all the drives across a rack, right, to get. And just the other thing to touch on with InfiniBand, I didn't mention before that back then it was very expensive to go from 1 gig to 10. Like, everybody was just doing LACP and bonded multiple gig connections. And the reason, one of the other reasons we picked InfiniBand was that natively InfiniBand back then was 20 gigabits per port, pushing to 40 gigabits per port. So, like, we were running 40 gig IB across our entire data center from 2011, which allowed us to do what we're doing now. But one thing to touch on real quick is actually the reason that we're using InfiniBand is purely the latency. So, like, it has something like 100 to 150 times less latency than Ethernet was back then, simply because it's RDMA, so remote direct memory access and zero copying memory, without having to encode it through a TCP stack.
Yeah.
And that's very key when you're trying to do iSCSI. Sorry, when you're trying to do storage-driven networking. Sorry, that's what I mean.
So why don't more people use it? I mean, I do know that, like you said, supercomputers and all that kind of stuff use it. So why don't more, even enterprises, I suppose, or service providers to that fact, use it? What do you think?
It's a little esoteric, so you need to, it doesn't, so the technical reason why InfiniBand wasn't super popular back in the day was that the Windows drivers were horrible. Like, Windows would continuously crash on it because it couldn't deal with the, like, how quick and how low latency the interconnect was. But that being said, like, a lot of people use InfiniBand every day just without knowing it. So if you buy, like, a lot of the large net app arrays were all InfiniBand internally for replication.
Yeah, okay, yep.
And then it was exported using FC or so basically the consuming interconnect isn't InfiniBand, but a lot of the internals are in a lot of systems. A lot of HFT firms would be using it because it's much for high frequency trading. As far as I understand, a lot of Bing and a lot of Azure internally storage is still InfiniBand as well. It's just that it's not as wide. I think it gets used in very specific applications, and
yeah,
a lot of the time it's tied to a lot of secret sauce, so people don't talk about it too much.
Get it?
So like direct data networks, a lot of the Isilon stuff, things like that were all InfiniBand internally.
Yeah,
They just front ended it with something else.
Yeah, there you go. So just moving through the history. So you guys, obviously, you got, because you were so young when you first started, like, you guys got a whole bunch of like awards and recognitions, right? Like, and also, did you get any? Have you had any investments or any angels or seed investments for you guys? Or
yeah, so this is, it's actually, I think I was mentioning this to you the other day. It's actually, when we look back now, like I said, when we were young, we were so tenacious and we were just going out there networking, meeting people. You never really took any criticism. Like, I remember Rene LeMay used to write articles about how we're in way too much press and none of it is not warranted and things like that. But it was a good human interest story, I think, was the reason. I don't think a lot of the press didn't honestly care about the tech. It was more about the fact that it was a bunch of teenagers building something.
Ultimate sort of Silicon Valley and Sydney story.
Yeah, exactly. And so, no, but we actually at the very beginning got, we built the company, we effectively launched it into production in 2011. And then we actually pushed it through to, we were very frugal back then. So our biggest costs were the rack space and the equipment and things like that. But we didn't need to pay ourselves very much to keep the lights on and things like that. So we were breaking even after a couple of months of launching it.
Yeah.
And we were actually at a couple of events, and we did bring in a couple of angel investors. Our first two seed investors were Gordon Bell, who, if anybody doesn't know who he is, he was the head of engineering at DEC back in the day. He built the DB11, the VAX,
right.
Signed off on the Ethernet standard himself, things like that. And then after being at DEC, he effectively helped Gates start Microsoft Research, and that's where he was for the last 35 years.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Past that. And then our second seed investor at the same time was, we didn't know much about people back then, it was actually Steve Baxter. And so many people will know Steve now from Shark Tank. We were, I think, his second seed investment after selling
Python. There you go.
We actually got invited because we were, because we were young, we got into a lot of people interested in talking to us. And so we actually got invited in a couple of months after Vocus had listed to pitch to the Vocus board about our platform. And they just introduced us as, hey, these are really smart guys, you should talk to them.
Yeah.
And they were trying to pull together a relatively large investment raise between the Vocus board. But then we said, hey, we like Steve, so we'll just take a little bit from Steve. We don't really need that much money right now. And
that might have gone a different way, right? Like, if Vocus had have pumped some money, and that might have actually, I mean, you'd probably be doing something different today, potentially.
Exactly. I would say that the first 5 or 6 years of Orion were just, I jokingly say it was us learning to be adults. We made so many mistakes.
Literally, right? Almost literally. People are out usually getting drunk and not knowing what they're doing, but you guys are running and trying to sort of seed and grow a massive company. So,
yeah. So we've definitely done, you can definitely look back at the history and see 3 or 4 times where we almost ran the thing into the ground just because we didn't know what we were doing. And then we just recovered it and fixed it. And I think the biggest mantra that Alex and I always, and it's been 10 years now, but our big philosophy internally is always perseverance. Like, it's you always end up with a lot of the hard situations, but if you just keep pushing through them, eventually you'll break through. Right. And so that's why I was saying before, like, I'm early 30s, but I feel like I'm 50 sometimes because of the amount
showing the
gray hairs we have sometimes.
but you're doing well, right? Because what I saw was that, you know, you were nominated in 2012 for an Australian Entrepreneur of the Year, and then 2013 Entrepreneur of the Year for Ernst & Young, right? So you've got all these awesome nominations, and then you won some awards in 2014. You know, so the company was doing well, but I think you said the headwinds were definitely, you know, starting to impact, right? So
yeah.
In around sort of 2013, and I remember seeing this, you started to sort of get your way and move into the States, right? So just explain a little bit about how Orion ended up, you know, being basically in San Francisco. What was it, California, basically? I can say California.
It was San Francisco, yeah.
You're in San Francisco, right? Almost in the heart of Silicon Valley doing stuff. And also maybe explain your transition from what was that traditional swipe your card to becoming a wholesaler.
Yeah, definitely. So interesting story is actually, as you're growing up, and like I said, we're a bunch of 20-year-olds, that I think a lot of tech people see the Valley as this little bit of this mecca that everybody has to go and visit. And so we went there, and like, I think we had a chat the other day about how eye-opening it is, and a lot of positive, but a lot of negative ways, depending on how you want to look at it. But Gordon Bell, one of our seed investors, was based in San Francisco. And like I said, we were pretty tenacious back then. I wish I had some of the courage. It's funny, as you get older, you start thinking things through a little bit more. But we literally just hopped on a plane and said, all right, we're going to go to the States for 2 months, and made a decision in an afternoon and just went there. The main reason behind it was Australia is a little bit backwards when it comes to technology. Like, there's still not many people building core tech like what we're trying to do in Australia. And it is much easier now to just hop on a video call. But we saw the opportunity to go to the US as being able to access, like, Alex is very big about, Alex, our CTO, is very big about being able to directly talk to really good tech companies before they become mainstream, so we can actually leverage any external technology components. Like, we were one of the first beta customers of Cumulus Linux, which is now a big NVIDIA acquisition as well, because we wanted completely open switching and to not be locked into Cisco. So a lot of our original, over the last 6 or 7 years, we've built a lot of partnerships in the States and a lot of connections, and you don't really leverage them immediately. Like, sometimes it takes you 4 or 5 years before you realize, oh, I know a guy from this thing that actually helps me with this. But I think looking back, I think I might have mentioned this the other day, we had to move to the States. Sorry, we wanted to move to the States because it was effectively a tech mecca. Looking back as a little bit older, we probably should have waited 2 or 3 years, gotten more market share here, because splitting between the US and Australia meant that we had a pretty split focus for the last 5 or 6 years, and it made it difficult to... and what we realized the hard way is what resonates in Australia doesn't resonate in the US, and vice versa. So we've had to effectively run two strategies for different markets.
Interesting. But
the wholesale strategy is definitely one that's worked. So just touching on that real quick, is we started as a retail provider. We knew that we used to sell a lot to startups and web companies and things like that. And the moment Amazon came to the market, the price of that capacity and the ability to win those customers kind of fell through the floor, because for a lot of startups, cloud is effectively free. Like, if you see these days and go online, it's like you register as a startup, you get 100 grand of Amazon credits. You just can't bootstrap a business off giving something for free for 2 years, right?
So, yeah.
Or sorry.
Which Amazon could do because they're so big. Yeah.
Exactly. So we decided to move it. So the story actually is that it's all incremental. We got asked by, so at Tech 23, which is one of the events we presented at, a startup event here in Sydney. We presented at that, and David Yule, who was actually the CEO of AAPT at the time, was in the audience. And so he asked for us to come in and meet him, and AAPT had sold about a year before their entire retail business to IINet. I don't know if you remember AAPT, had AAPT Smart Chat and all that stuff. That jingle.
Yeah, the jingle's so in my head. It's in my head now. I'm going to be thinking about that all day now.
So they sold that, and then they... AAPT had a desire to try to get back into the retail game after their contracts post-sale had all expired. And so they approached us and said, you've got this great technology. We want to be in the cloud space. They had a brand called connect.com.au, which used to be an older telco that they bought. And so we actually worked with them for about a year and a half to take our Orion V1 platform and white label it and write a whole bunch of integration code to make it the connect.com.au platform. And that kind of set us down the track of, oh, if AAPT needs it, then how many telcos, how many MSPs need a cloud solution that aren't going to want to invest in a whole team to build it?
Yeah.
And that's what started us down the journey of realizing that most of our clients that were actually successful were on selling our product. as MSPs as well. And so we decided to effectively pivot the company into to building wholesale solutions.
So just on that as well, just quickly. So it's not only the case of wholesaling, which I think people, you know, when you've got a reseller model, reseller channel, mm-hmm. you know, you can mm-hmm. kind of do that, but you can't do it like what I've seen you guys do it. Because we talk about white labeling. Now, white labeling in this industry could just mean that you buy someone else's, you know, platform and you offer it to your customer, but it's not technically white labeled. But your mm-hmm. white labeling is proper white labeling, isn't it? Like it's end to end. You wouldn't even.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I think that we were from a technology perspective probably a little bit overly strict about what we were calling white labeling. Like I look at the market today, and there's a lot of white label cloud solutions. And you're right, a lot of people just call it white label because you can on bill it to someone else.
That's it. That's my point, right?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Whereas our white labeling was everything from being able to have your own domain name, your own IP address space, your own SSL certificates, sure, everything to make it completely white labeled. And so we spent a lot of time actually building that. Like our wholesale platform today is completely multi-tiered as well. So we realized that like there's always these weird and wonderful distribution strategies. Like every company wants to do something slightly different. So we tried to make it quite flexible. And all of that came out of the fact that when we built it for APT, like they had a bunch of requirements. Then we talked to other MSPs and they had, so it's truly iterative over a decade of building the solution and scaling it. And the next iteration of that, just to tag onto the end of that, is that we're starting to finally realize, all right, the core of what Orion's value prop is, in addition to the wholesale cloud, is really the technology. And so the next evolution of what we're doing is what we call our micro prop strategy, our micro point of presence, where we're effectively packaging what we do into a half rack or a multi-rack deployment and effectively launching that with data centers and telcos around the world, targeting specific areas where cloud has not penetrated as highly as
is that almost like are we talking about sort of like a competitor to what like AWS has with their edge situation?
Similar messaging to Outpost, but I think it's less about the enterprise. Outpost is very much about being able to give you a rack that a bank could run in their building and things like that to be on premise. But it's not super, it's not really service provider focused a lot of the time. It's it's very similar incarnation to that, but purely service provider focused. So we've seen, and if you had told me 10 years ago that we wouldn't be through this cloud journey 10 years on, because it's funny, back when we were building our, and we were talking in 2011, we were saying, all right, if we don't have a strong solution in 2 years, the market's going to be owned, et cetera, by the big boys.
Hasn't happened, has it?
Yeah. Hasn't happened. So what we're finding is actually where we're getting a lot of demand for our micropop solutions is regional data centers and regional telcos that don't have an Amazon presence directly close to it. So for example, we're getting a lot of interest out of Canada, a lot of the flyover states that want something locally in the States, different parts of Europe, Asia, where Amazon isn't there and we can, and our strategy is not to just deploy it on Orion's own. We effectively partner with a large partner there, like a telco or an MSP that already has a large target market.
Some sort of anchor, some sort of anchor client.
And we co-invest into the build. And what a micropop is effectively a private cloud as a service, if you want to call it that, but with a little bit of an ecosystem model tagged on, because not only do we sell them cloud capacity, we typically add more cloud capacity, and then that will become a new region for Orion that we can sell to all of our other partners as well. So it adds on both sides of the, like one Daniel, our CEO likes to call it our, we have a bottom up and a top, top down and a bottom up approach.
Yeah.
So like top down is a channel model, and a bottom up is taking a data center and cloud enabling it. And that model also branches a lot into what I want to call legacy hardware providers that want to cloudify their business and things like that. So we're seeing a lot of demand for the IP to be able to be the core building block for another cloud solution. And we're leveraging that a lot more to as we scale the business. So I think that's what's going to be the next 5 to 8 years of our businesses effectively.
That's really cool. I like that strategy. So at the moment, you've got 6 global data center locations. So from memory, 3 in Australia, 3 in America.
Primarily Australia, US.
Did you go to Melbourne recently?
We've had the Melbourne pop there for about 3 years or so. So it's been a while. One thing I didn't mention before is a key reason we're doing wholesale is because really, honestly, if you look at our team makeup, we're a bunch of tech guys and we're not amazing at tech and sales and marketing. Yeah. So let's, the whole model allowed us to fold into that.
So how big is the, well, how big was the Ryan team when it started? Probably three, what I'm
three guessing. People, yeah.
And now how big
We're still fairly lean. We're at about 20 people now split between the US and Australia. We have a couple of people in New Zealand, a couple of people just kind of different parts of the US. But our two main offices are San Francisco and Sydney.
And what split is tech versus sales or marketing? I mean, I'm guessing not a lot of the former.
It's primarily tech. And even our sales and marketing teams all have tech backgrounds as well. So like there's a lot of our solutions sales are quite technical. It's about understanding what MSP wants to do. So very similar, I think, in theory, your role is a marketing role, but you're highly technical as well, right? So I think our sales teams look very similar to that, in that we're expected to be the specialist for the partner of ours. Our sales team, our true sales teams, are actually the sales teams of our partners, because what we do is not only do we cloud enable a partner, we actually have to help them sell it, otherwise no one's making anything on the way through. Yeah. So we train their teams and enable them to become successful in the sales.
The only way you can scale, right? That's the only way a lot of us, well, when I say us, formerly us, in the business of competing against AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, IBM, it's the only way that we can grow is by enabling our partners to know enough to go to their partners and resellers and then go to their customers and grow it out from there.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. It's basically enabling the trusted advisors so that they can go through and assist their client. But I was hopping on for a little bit too much.
No, that's okay. It's all intriguing, and people are listening and definitely interested in this for sure. So from what I've seen, the last two or three years have been quite massive, though. Like, I've read somewhere 600% increase in terms of just footprint and whatnot. That's a huge. So, what do you put to that? Why have you grown all of a sudden in the last couple of years? It's interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely tied to the channel model. So, the channel wholesale model, for the first couple of years, it's all about thought leadership, education, trying to get people off the ground about how to do it. And realistically, for every partner that comes on, it probably takes them 6 to 12 months before they're actually kind of rolling on their own steam. And so that's been the big kind of, a lot of the growth has come from the fact that we've underpinned a couple of really good partners here in Australia and the US that have been scaling on their own steam. And quite a few of them are doing 5, 10, depending on the partner, 15% month-to-month growth in their sales. And what we're doing is effectively back-ending that, but we're not having to sell every one of those deals. So that helps from a scalability perspective, and it's the reason why we're able to stay lean as a team.
That's pretty cool.
But what we've also noticed, just as a comment as well, is that a lot of MSPs now, because Amazon and Azure are making it so easy for them to consume things as a service, the products that we were able to deliver back in 2012, 2013, where it was, here's a VM and you go do your own thing. A lot more things are moving to needing to be turnkey services, right? So over the last couple of years, we've had to build a lot more investment into turnkey backups as a service, turnkey DR as a service, things that the client can just, our MSPs can just take to their clients without having to build
it. I want to come and chat to that and talk about it very quickly. Because again, we could talk for hours on this and keep it cracking, but I wanted to ask some questions like, so we've obviously talked about the core innovations and services that you build on. You know, you've talked about the Infinity Band, you've talked about Zen, you've talked about the networking. So we've done that. How do you feel though through that you were able to disrupt the market initially?
Yeah, so definitely at the beginning, it's interesting. As tech guys, we always used to focus on the technology and the platform and things like that. But realistically, a lot of what we did at the beginning was a lot of guerrilla marketing. It was a lot of going out there and networking and hustling effectively to build the business. And so I think the technology is good. But what we've learned obviously the hard way is technology doesn't win deals, right? You have to deliver a business outcome and you have to be trusted. Actually, one of the biggest things that makes our life a lot easier now is that we have been around for 10 years. The first 3 or 4 years were like, we had
to be so much more confident. Yeah, who are these kids?
Exactly. Well, who are these teenagers and why would we trust them? Like literally our competitors were saying, why would you trust the teenagers with your enterprise workloads?
Yeah, can't confirm or deny that, but I never knew how young you were. If I knew how young you were, I might have used that.
Yeah, but so I think we just proved it over time that we're still around. We've kept the lights on. We've got some big client brands. And I think now it just makes it easier to sell that. Plus, we're actually older now, so I think we're about the age that people expected us to be when we started it.
How do you continue to disrupt yourselves internally? So I think I can answer this because what I've seen, and you know, well, like you mentioned too, you're not just selling a VM anymore. You're selling object storage, DR. You're selling analytics, like those turnkey solutions. So how do you continually disrupt yourself internally to continue that innovative way forward?
Yeah. No, so I think that the idea is really talking to the clients and working out what they're asking for. Like, there's a wealth of knowledge, especially in these IT providers that actually know what their clients are asking for. And you'd have to take that knowledge in. For a long time, we were just basically saying, hey, like, we only sell X. And I think a lot of our methodology, like our internal thought process, has moved from just saying, no, you'll buy what we give you, to listening a little bit more and trying to take that on board. To be honest with you, we're probably less in, like, and I think any kind of older tech company can tell you this, we're less innovative than we used to be. If you want to think about that. Like, you end up getting baggage and SLAs and
technical debt.
You actually care. Yeah, technical debt, but also on top of that, you actually care about uptime a lot more now. So you're a lot more careful about how everything goes.
Okay, yeah.
Like I said, back then we kept the platform running perfectly fine, but I think, like I said before, like the best practices back in the day were a lot looser than what they are now.
Yeah.
And what the client expectations were quite a lot looser. So as those have tightened up, like, we innovate a whole bunch internally, but the process to actually get it to production is arguably slower because we have to test it. And the more data centers you have, the more effort it takes.
I mean, I'm just looking at what you guys offer today, like big data analytics, hosted PBX and VoIP, which I guess from the InfiniBand and the speed of your platform, that kind of lends itself perfectly to that. E-commerce, the VDI and DRAS you're doing, so storage and archiving, and DR and backup. So you're doing the whole gamut. So you guys have innovated and moved forward without question, through the natural progression of the company, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And what we've learned a lot as well with those solutions is we've opened up our book a little bit, and we innovate in a lot of those solutions together with our partners rather than trying to do it all alone. So we still are very strong in the core technology, where it's compute, storage, bare metal as a service, all the building blocks. But a lot of the solutions that you were calling out then, what we've done to be able to get them to market relatively quickly is found a partner that was looking to cloudify their model and work with them on it, and then adopt that solution once we know that it works. So it's much more of a joint approach to development rather than a partner led model, rather than a do it all alone. You can only, like, as you get more mature in this, you try to reinvent the wheel less because it ends up with a lot of technical debt and a lot of overhead.
Yeah. You slow down the reinvention, but I think your flywheel, as I call it in the industry, starts to get a steam, and you're just adding all these cogs, which make the flywheel go quicker and quicker. You mentioned the technology partners. So what makes a great technology partner for you? And maybe in this question, let's split it two ways, because obviously you've just mentioned tech partners that you partner with to offer and create these services. But then I think this is a different question to other guys I've talked with, because you guys have done this all by yourself to a certain extent in terms of the Zen and the InfiniBand. So let's do it in two parts. Great tech partner for how you approach services, and great tech partner for your underlying technology.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do we determine who's what? I think from an underlying technology perspective, Alex, as our CTO, spends a lot of time researching, like, all right, where do we want to be? And what's the next greatest thing in technology? Like, obviously now it's a bit older, but NVMe and GPUs and things like that, how do we integrate those technologies in? And a lot of the reason we are in the Valley is that a lot of those companies go to the Valley to get funding to meet people. And as we meet them, we can go through and say, all right, how do we, because they're younger and more, sorry, those companies are newer and more innovative, they're really willing to work more with a smaller partner to make a product work. And so we try to find, like, people like Cumulus Linux. We work with a big inverse hypervisor company called TidalScale that did large compute aggregation. Like, so we basically go into the network and find those tech partners and work together with them to build a joint product. Typically what we do, especially for the newer tech partners, is we bring them a business model and an ecosystem that they don't already have. And we try to say, all right, have you thought about selling it as a service, or have you thought about it as doing it this way? And so we've actually been quite successful at taking something that somebody was just about to sell a software or put in a box and say, let me use our platform and built a subscription, and let's bolt on a subscription model for this.
Yeah.
So that a lot of your clients can try it before having to drop $500,000 on a piece of hardware, right? And things like that. So that's on the technology side. And then on the business side, realistically, it's about finding, and we've worked with everything from a two-man band up to a large scale enterprise company. And we try to find somewhere in the middle, someone that actually has a decent depth of clients. On the business partner side, we're generally trying to find somebody that has a lot of depth in a whole team, but in a business that's tangential to cloud. So yeah. We tend to be quite successful in cloud enabling MPLS aggregators or private network providers or ISPs, because you can sell a joint product and the cloud pushes. Selling the cloud obviously gives them margin and gives them innovation, but at the same time also drives greater demand for their existing products. So we try to find the bolt-on providers that we can bolt cloud onto and add it as a secondary. And it does take time. Like, you have to, there's a lot of business transformation in what we do now rather than purely tech. Like, a lot of it is understanding what the clients, what the management team wants to do, and how do we get the business across the line with that. And I suppose that's probably where a lot of the consulting background I had in the past helps. And a lot of the knowledge that we have helps. But that's how we build the strong partnerships that, like, if you take a business that doesn't have a cloud competency today and invest a little bit into them, into building their cloud competency, if they already have 1,000 customers that all buy network from them, it makes perfect sense to then sell them cloud on
there. That's a network effect, right? That's a network effect of partnering someone who's got their own established network to do something really easy. Well, that's amazing. I think we'll wrap up. And again, we could talk for hours on this, and hopefully we'll catch up later on in future times and stay in touch. But for me, where you guys are set in terms of the wholesale market, you can totally hit a component of the market that probably at this point would be toing and froing, and maybe even be like, are we going to start something to offer some sort of cloud service to some of our customer base? Because we've been a managed service provider. How do we do that? Well, let's not build it because it costs a lot of money and it's hard and it's difficult. It's complex and we haven't got the talent or the IP. Let's go and look at a Orion VM to do a wholesale model to white label it. So, and that's at a small level, but that can also be at a much larger level. That could be a provider that wants to get out of a certain game and come in with an easier stack. So you guys are really doing some great things with some amazing technology, which is behind the scenes, right? And so I love that story. So thanks, Shane, for being on. It's been a great episode. For those, we'll add the show notes. You can find out all about Orion VM. You can find out about all their history. We'll put some links on there to their website and some of their offers. You can find me at anthonyspiteri.net. Great things with Great Tech is now on Twitter itself, GTWGT podcast, and obviously GTWGT.com. And again, just a reminder, if you aren't subscribed or if you're new to the show, please like, please subscribe down in the bottom right corner. And with that, thanks to Shane, thanks to Orion VM, and we will catch you next time.